Chapter 14, The Birth of Compound Growth. The Slow Transformation. The transition from suspicion of interest to the celebration of compound growth was not sudden. It took centuries and involved intellectual, institutional, and technological changes that reinforced one another. New theories justified new financial institutions. Those institutions facilitated new technologies. New technologies generated wealth that made the new theories appear increasingly plausible. Together, they created a self-reinforcing system in which compound growth became a foundation of modern civilization. The transformation wasn't inevitable. It emerged from choices made by rulers, merchants, philosophers, religious thinkers, and eventually economists, shaped by wars, plagues, discoveries, and inventions. But once established, the system acquired momentum of its own. The intellectual transformation. The intellectual transformation began during the Renaissance, as classical learning returned and new approaches to understanding the world developed. Medieval scholastic thinkers had struggled to reconcile the prohibition of interest with the practical requirements of commerce. Over time, they developed arguments allowing compensation for risk, opportunity cost, inflation, and other factors. The absolute prohibition gradually weakened. The Reformation accelerated the process. John Calvin, for example, argued that biblical restrictions on interest applied particularly to lending to the poor rather than to commercial lending. Interest increasingly became acceptable as a normal feature of economic activity. The Enlightenment pushed the transformation further. Economists such as Adam Smith, David Ricardo, and Jean-Baptiste Say developed theories of capital, interest, production, and markets that treated financial returns as part of an increasingly systematic economic framework. The most important conceptual shift was the changing meaning of capital. In the ancient and medieval world, capital was largely understood as accumulated wealth. In the modern economy, it increasingly came to be understood as a productive factor, an asset capable of generating future income. Now, you might be thinking, so we figured out that capital is productive. What's the big deal? The big deal is that once capital was understood as productive, interest could be understood differently. It was no longer necessarily a payment extracted from someone else's misfortune. It could be seen as a return on productive investment. The usurer gradually became the investor. The sin became a productive return. The institutional transformation. New financial institutions emerged to accumulate and deploy capital at increasing scale. Banks developed across Europe, particularly in the Italian city-states, providing loans, accepting deposits, transferring money, and facilitating trade. Families such as the Medici helped establish banking networks that connected merchants, rulers, and markets across Europe. Joint stock companies were another crucial innovation. The Dutch East India Company, founded in 1602, allowed investors to pool capital and share risk. This model became an important foundation for the modern corporation. Stock exchanges provided secondary markets where shares and bonds could be bought and sold, increasing liquidity and improving price discovery. Insurance added another layer of financial infrastructure. Marine, fire, and eventually life insurance allowed investors and businesses to manage risks that might otherwise have discouraged investment. These institutions did more than facilitate commerce. They changed the relationship between finance and society. In earlier societies, economic relationships were deeply embedded in social relationships. As modern markets developed, economic activity increasingly became treated as a separate sphere governed by its own rules. We still see the legacy of this shift today. We talk about the economy as though it were an external force rather than a system created and maintained by human institutions. The technological transformation. Financial and intellectual changes were reinforced by technological ones. The factory system brought workers and machines together, enabling greater division of labor, specialization, and coordination. Production that had once taken place in homes and small workshops increasingly moved into large-scale industrial facilities. The steam engine provided a new source of mechanical power. Coal could be converted into energy independently of human muscle, animal power, wind, or water. Railways then transform transportation. They reduce the cost and time of moving goods and people, expanded markets, and connected regions on an unprecedented scale. These technologies reinforced one another. Steam power helped drive factories and railways. Railways transported the coal that powered steam engines. Factories produced goods for expanding markets. Technology and finance therefore developed together, each increasing the potential of the other. The mathematical breakthrough. The intellectual, institutional, and technological transformation was accompanied by a deeper mathematical understanding of compound interest. Compound interest itself was ancient. What changed in the modern era was its formalization and integration into an increasingly sophisticated financial system. The mathematics is simple but powerful. Future value equals principal times 1 plus interest rate to the power of n. A loan or investment growing at 5% annually becomes 1.05 to the power of n times its original value after n years. The rule of 72 provides a rough estimate of doubling time. Divide 72 by the interest rate at 5%, an investment doubles in roughly 14.4 years, at 10% about 7.2 years. And here's the crucial point. The same mathematics that makes compound returns attractive to investors makes compound debt dangerous to borrowers. If you're earning 5% on your savings, compounding is your friend. If you're paying 5% on a large debt, compounding works against you. For a government carrying enormous debt, even modest interest rates can create substantial obligations over time. Compound growth therefore became both a powerful engine of wealth accumulation and a mechanism through which financial claims could grow independently of the underlying economy. The moral reversal. The deepest transformation was moral. In the ancient and medieval world, usury was widely treated as a moral problem. Lending at interest could be seen as profiting from another person's need. In the modern world, interest itself became increasingly normal. Usury came to mean excessive or exploitative interest rather than interest generally. At the same time, capital changed from something associated primarily with accumulated wealth into something understood as productive. This changed the moral status of financial returns. Interest could now be justified as compensation for providing productive capital. The transformation extended beyond interest. The economy itself increasingly came to be treated as a technical system, governed by its own mechanisms, rather than as a moral institution subject to explicit social constraints. That separation allowed economic activity to expand on an unprecedented scale. It also made it easier to overlook the social and environmental consequences of that expansion. The engine of growth. By the 19th century, the basic elements of the new system were established. Interest was no longer inherently suspect. Capital was understood as productive. Compound growth had become an important mechanism for accumulating wealth. The resulting cycle was powerful. Capital to investment to technology, to productivity, to profits, to reinvestment, to more capital. Fossil fuels amplified the cycle. Coal, oil, and natural gas provided enormous quantities of concentrated energy, allowing machines to replace human and animal labor and expanding the scale of production. Population growth provided another tailwind. More people meant more workers, consumers, and potential innovators. Resource extraction provided another. New land, minerals, and energy sources supplied the inputs required by industrial expansion. Together, these forces produced an extraordinary period of economic growth. Between 1820 and 2000, global GDP increased many times over. Living standards rose dramatically across much of the world. Life expectancy increased, literacy expanded, and the material conditions of human life were transformed. The achievement was real. But so were the conditions that made it possible. The inevitability question. Was this transformation inevitable? No. It was the result of particular choices and circumstances. different religious interpretations, political decisions, technological developments, wars, discoveries, and institutions could have produced a different path. The transformation was also dependent on abundant fossil fuels and resources. Coal powered the Industrial Revolution. Oil powered much of the expansion that followed. Population growth provided a major demographic tailwind. Remove enough of these conditions, and the trajectory changes. The system of compound growth was therefore not a law of nature. It was a historical outcome produced by a particular combination of institutions, technologies, resources, and demographics. And that matters because what people created can be redesigned. The legacy of the transformation. We have inherited this system. Compound growth is embedded in financial markets, government borrowing, pensions, investment expectations, corporate structures, and economic policy. It shapes how we think about the future and what we expect from it. Its legacy is mixed. On one side, the system generated extraordinary prosperity. It lifted billions of people from extreme poverty, expanded opportunity, and enabled technological and scientific achievements that would have been unimaginable to earlier generations. On the other, it contributed to enormous concentrations of wealth and power, environmental destruction, and an economic structure increasingly dependent on continued expansion. More importantly, many of the conditions that supported the great expansion are changing. Population growth is slowing. Resources are becoming more constrained. Environmental costs are rising. The era of exceptionally cheap fossil energy cannot simply be assumed to continue indefinitely. We cannot simply abandon the financial system that developed during the Great Expansion. It is too deeply embedded in modern society. But we can redesign parts of it. The productivity bond is one such redesign. It doesn't eliminate debt or interest. Instead, it changes the relationship between financial returns and economic performance by linking the return to productivity rather than requiring perpetual expansion. The path forward. The transformation from the ancient suspicion of interest to the modern celebration of compound growth took centuries. The transformation we now need will not happen overnight either. Moving from a system dependent on perpetual growth toward one that rewards productivity will require changes in ideas, institutions, and technology. But the principle is straightforward. Debt is a human institution. Financial contracts are human inventions. The way we structure returns is a choice. We don't need to return to the ancient suspicion of interest. We need to recover the insight behind it. Financial claims have limits, debt creates relationships, and the financial system ultimately exists to serve the economy and society. The productivity bond is one practical, testable step in that direction. The transformation from suspicion to celebration created the physical and institutional conditions for the great expansion of the last two centuries, an era built on five pillars: land, population, fossil fuels, industrialization, and global trade.